Today on our final jury break, I'm talking to Jessa about sentencing, and we wind up also discussing what really happens on Suicide Watch. On Wednesday, we're releasing the final chapter of our follow-up series for season one. But don't unsubscribe, because sometime in December, I'm releasing a bonus episode about Samantha Hall's sentencing, and we are coming back January 3rd with a brand new season, even more controversial than this one. I'm actually pretty nervous about it. So sit back and enjoy this ad-free episode. What is your experience like as a criminal defense attorney? Obviously, if you get to a sentencing hearing, I'm assuming that you have lost the case that you've worked on.
That's probably true if there was a trial.
Okay.
So just some fun facts, some statistics for you. Less than 5% of criminal cases actually go to trial. So 95% of the time, what we do as criminal defense attorneys is negotiate potential solutions short of trial. So we negotiate guilty pleas, sometimes to the charge as it was originally issued, a lot of times to a lesser charge. And then there are two types of sentencings. There's a sentencing where everything is agreed, so the prosecution and the defense both make the same recommendation. And then there's an argued sentencing, which is when the prosecution asks for one thing and the defense asks for the other and the judge decides. So I probably appear more in sentencing hearings than I do in any other capacity as a lawyer, because they're just so common.
Wow. Okay. So does that mean that the level to which you know your defendant varies a great deal between hearings?
It probably does for lawyers that have a higher volume of cases. And I just want to say, as I explain this, that this is in no way a knock on the wonderful people that have chosen to be public defenders who have devoted their life to indigent defense. That said, lots of public defenders I know have 100 or 200 open cases. I usually have somewhere between 25 and 35 open cases. So I have the opportunity to spend a lot of time getting to know each of my individual defendants. And the busier the lawyer is, and it's not that I'm not busy. I consider what I have a full caseload. It's just the amount of cases that I can take to perform at the level that my office requires. But a lot of times, you know, if you've got 200 people and you only get 5 minutes with them, they're just not going to know the same amount of things about a defendant that I'm going to, because I spend hours with them. So I very rarely have a sentencing where I don't know my defendant at least reasonably well.
I see. Would you say that sentencing hearings are the most emotional or on the most emotional end of the spectrum when it comes to court hearings for the defendant?
You know, it's so hard to say, because there are different emotions in every aspect of the process. So, I mean, I think that probably the initial appearance for a defendant when they're first in court and being accused, I think that's probably a very emotional moment for a defendant. If there's a trial, trials are very emotional for defendants. One of the clearest memories that I have of practicing law is a defendant breaking down during a break in a homicide trial, and I'll just never forget it. There's like this little door, and I'm getting off track, but I'm going to tell it anyway because I started. There's this little door to the side of the courtroom where in custody defendants are taken in and out outside of the presence of the jury. And the lawyers typically aren't allowed back there. That's a place for just the bailiffs and the defendant. And defendants get to wear street clothes, so they're dressed in a suit and tie, even though they are in custody. And I was trying a homicide, my first homicide trial, actually. I had handled a couple before that, but this was the first one that went to trial. And I was just starting my case, and it was a self-defense case. And my defendant, who I really liked and I still really like, and I occasionally hear from him, so it's not as though he's left my thoughts over the years, but he started to really get upset while a police officer was testifying. And I noticed that because his knee sort of started bobbing up and down. You know, like you could tell he was fidgety and he was getting red in the ears. And so I asked for a sidebar and approach. And I said, you know, I think there's going to be a problem here. Can we clear the jury out? And the judge did. And just as the jury left the room, he sort of let out this wail and said, you know, I never meant for any of this to happen. And in trial, you're on a really tight timetable. Like, you've got X number of days scheduled for trial, and the court wants you to accomplish that. And so the judge was sort of looking at me saying, you know, we've got to get moving. And so I said, I need a 15-minute recess. And they put me back in this little room with this defendant who was a big guy. I mean, he was probably like 6'4", and, you know, 230, 240. I mean, big, you know, big muscular guy. And he was set to testify that day. And I mean, this just sticks out so clearly for me. I was wearing this pale pink blouse and this camel suit and pearls because I was still a young lawyer. And I had read that if you like soften your appearance when your defendant testifies, that that is helpful. And he threw himself at me, and the bailiffs all reacted because they thought he was attacking me, and he wasn't. He just wanted a hug because nobody had hugged him in 14 months.
Oh,
because he was locked up. And I mean, his whole family is out in the courtroom, and he just threw himself on me and just sobbed on my chest, and it soaked through my blouse. And I remember just standing in this little room in the side of this courthouse thinking, this is such an incredible moment, and I am so woefully inadequate as a comforter in this moment. Like, I had just turned 28. I'd been practicing law for like 4 or 5 years. And I just remember thinking, like, this is so big and so overwhelming, and I don't know what to do. And all I can do is hold on to this poor man for dear life and pat his back and hope that this provides some type of comfort. And we took deep breaths and we talked about, you know, other things. I mean, I tried to distract him. And then he ultimately got on the witness stand in the time that the judge had allotted it. But that was just one of the most emotionally intense moments I've ever had as an attorney. And I don't think I'll ever forget it because his family was just, you know, 15 feet away, but between guards and doors. And that was what he needed. And he couldn't have that. All he had was me.
Oh, my God.
You know, so the trials are emotional. I can tell you as a lawyer, there is nothing worse, and worse is the right word, than like the minute and a half it takes for the jury to walk in while you know the foreperson is holding the verdict. And then the bailiff goes and gets that piece of paper and walks it to the judge from the jury box to the bench. And the judge reads it, and the judge usually raises an eyebrow no matter what it is. You know, guilty or not guilty, that minute and a half is probably, I mean, if my heart rate is below 220 during that minute and a half, I'd be stunned. And, you know, I've had dozens and dozens of trials, and I've had trials that deal with really low level stuff. And I've had homicide trials and sexual assault trials. And it doesn't matter even really what the stakes are in that minute and a half. It's just like this intense anticipation. And so that's another really emotional moment sort of in the court process. And then sentencing is probably right up there. I've had some pretty dramatic sentencings. I have a friend who we text each other and we'll say, oh, it was a USP today, which is just our code for unmitigated shit parade, that there are cameras, you know, that there are all sorts of really hostile and angry speakers on the prosecution side, that there are equally hostile and angry speakers on the defense side, and that it takes hours. So sentencing can be really dramatic and really emotional because the rules of evidence aren't applied. People kind of have a free-for-all. They're able to talk about things that weren't necessarily admissible at trial. You get to hear a lot more about a defendant's character. You get to hear a lot more about a victim's character because people who are, you know, survivors of a victim, if it's a homicide, or even in cases where there's not a death, sometimes the family members and friends can speak too. So it can be a pretty intense day. Like, serious sentencings are pretty intense days.
Have you ever been completely shocked by the sentencing, the sentence that was handed down?
Yes. I have. So in my state, with felony cases, the Department of Corrections prepares something called a pre-sentence investigation. And it's basically this big packet of information about a defendant. It details the defense, you know, like the history of the offense. It talks about their family history, their substance abuse history, their sexual history, if it's a sex crime, employment history, all of that. And then at the and it also talks about what the victim's feelings are and tries to present itself as neutrally as possible. A lot of times the defense attorney will hire a private PSI writer, so we're not just relying on the Department of Corrections. But they make a recommendation. And usually those recommendations, while not binding on a judge, influence the judge fairly heavily. So, I mean, I've had cases where, and I'm thinking of one in particular, where the PSI recommended somewhere between 7 and 9 years of initial confinement. So 7 and 9 years in custody, and then there'd be some period of what Wisconsin calls extended supervision, what the rest of America calls parole. I don't know why we do that, but we do.
Sure.
And the judge gave my guy 20 years in. And that was a pretty rough day, I think, for everybody, because we felt reasonably good going into it, because this recommendation tends to drive the decision making. So I've had that. There are, in those joint recommendation moments, so those sentences that everybody agrees, occasionally a judge will jump a joint recommendation. And that's always a pretty surprising thing and a pretty bad day typically for the defense, because we're going in saying, look, you don't have to go to jail. We're going to put you on probation for 3 years. The prosecutor agrees. Everybody's cool with that. And then all of a sudden the judge says, no, you're going to prison. When you haven't prepped your defendant for that, those are hard days. Like, those are hard days in my profession. And I do always try and make it clear to a defendant the judge can do whatever he or she wants. However, you know, 99% of the time the judge follows a joint recommendation. And so those days are always outliers. And I mean, I don't have a more eloquent way to say it. They just fucking suck.
Yeah.
Like, it just sucks.
You know what I've always wondered is immediately following a verdict being delivered or a sentence being handed down, how quickly are you able to see your client? Because in the movies and TV, you see the defendant being taken away, or the convict, you know, depending on the time this is happening, like being taken away and like from the defense attorney's table, like sort of ripped from your arms. Like, how soon can you get in touch with them? Because that must be a really frightening moment for those people.
So I have never had a problem. I just tell everyone, I'm walking back with you. I'm going with you. I won't leave a defendant. When they take the defendant away, I follow them. And I just tell the bailiffs, look, I'm coming. There's nothing you can do about that. I'm going.
Oh, I see.
You know. And I've never had a problem with that. And if I did, usually they've just got to transport somebody from the courthouse to the jail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like in my home county, those buildings, there's like a tunnel that connects the courthouse to the jail. So they just walk through the tunnel and then you can go see them 10 minutes later in the jail. Some buildings, the jail and the courthouse, are the same building. And so that's quite easy. But I mean, anytime I get a guilty verdict, I always immediately go see my client and sit with them. Wow. If they're in custody, which, you know, is a super happy, fun time.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine. That must be so difficult.
It, you know, if ever there's a check to make sure that a defense attorney will do her job properly, it's knowing that if someone is convicted, you have to go sit and explain to them what you did to fuck up their life. I always just sort of set the bar as I need to do everything I can to make sure that if they're convicted, this is not my fault.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, I mean,
following guilty convictions or you know, guilty findings or slash convictions, do you find that your clients have responded to you with a multitude of emotions? Like, have you gotten anger? Have you gotten like remorse? Have you just seen the gamut?
So I, you know, I've seen a pretty broad spectrum of that. Most of my clients are not angry at me. You know, I think they can be frustrated at the judge or at the jury, but I'm typically not the source of that anger, mm-hmm. which I'm very grateful for because I would probably internalize that.
Yeah.
If I were, you know, if somebody said, this is your fault, I would probably lose sleep over that. So that's typically not what I experience my clients. And I take a lot of pride in that, that my clients typically feel as though I have fought for them regardless of what the outcome is. And that's very important to me. Sometimes they're angry. A lot of times people in serious cases, you know, where you're talking about potentially decades in prison, I worry about suicidal ideation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so that's part of the reason that I always go and kind of talk to them to just see where they're at. There are other reasons that I hate making that phone call, because like here, if you're concerned about someone's potential for committing suicide, they put you in like med psych, which involves being in nothing but a suicide smock and having a light on you 24 hours a day in solitary. And so unless I really think a client is at risk of suicide, I won't suggest that because I know it's unpleasant for them. But you know, I worry about suicide.
Well, can you go on? That's just, sorry, I know I'm derailing you, but I've always been curious about Suicide Watch and what exactly that entails.
So here, and I can't speak for everywhere, but here we have this like ward that is the psych ward at the jail. And it's a row of cells that instead of having cellmates, you're placed individually. And in Dane County, my home county, sometimes they'll force you to remove your clothing because you can hang yourself with jail blues pants.
Oh.
So, I mean, we have clients not routinely, but occasionally that when they come through initial appearance court, the only thing they're wearing is a suicide smock and shackles.
Is that suicide smock like a hospital gown?
It looks sort of like if you've ever had an x-ray done, you know, like that lead thing they make you wear.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. So it's yeah. So it's kind of covers your sensitive bits, and is sleeveless and sort of Velcros itself together. And then they'll be in leg irons and handcuffs. If people are assessed as being a risk to others, sometimes they'll be in a spit mask. And that's a very special moment. Let me tell you, the first time I ever had a client come out wearing a spit mask, which makes them look like Hannibal fucking Lecter.
Oh, God. Is it like that? Is it like a muzzle?
Yeah, it's totally like that. And you're just like, what the fuck is this? You know, because these are things that for those of you that one day go to law school, these are things that they don't teach you in law school. That maybe one day you're going to walk into a courtroom and there's going to be somebody in the Hannibal Lecter mask and shackles.
Jesus.
You know, that's really quite startling. I mean.
Oh, my God. I mean, just to think about someone who's already so emotionally distraught that someone would flag them as being a risk of harming themselves and then to sort of... I'm not going to use the word humiliate because I understand it's in their best interest. They're trying to protect these people from self-harm, but like, you know, putting them in a smock in which they're like barely covered in which they feel probably less human than they did before. And then putting masks on their face. I mean, God, that just must make the situation from a psychological standpoint so much worse immediately. It's difficult to think
about.
It's pretty
heartbroken. Heartbroken. What the hell? it's tough. And that's, you know, there's so much to the visual mm-hmm. in the way that we treat people. And we can say, you know, I mean, I'm 12 years into this, almost 12 years into this. I I don't think it's right to say that I'm used to seeing spit masks because those are rare, but I am fairly used to seeing suicide smocks. And the idea that you can send a person into an initial appearance court naked, but for like this lead vest, you know, yeah, okay, the judge has seen that before, but God, does that otherize people?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that doesn't look like you or me. And none of us can really imagine being that person because they look so different than a place that we picture ourselves ever being.
Right.
And that just sort of starts the bias against somebody accused of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, I mean, imagine you're an innocent person who's accused of killing your wife. It's not crazy that you would be suicidal upon being arrested. Right. And then you're dragged into this little courtroom where they set bail at an amount you probably can't post. And you're basically naked and handcuffed and there are cameras there. I mean, you would feel like an animal.
Yeah.
People look like animals. You know what I mean? And it's not their fault. Like, I'm not saying they are. But I can't even imagine what that must feel like for people.
Oh.
Happy things.
Happy things. Oh my God. Well, I mean, this started out as a talk about sentencing hearing, but I have actually always been fascinated by Suicide Watch and what that looks like and what those circumstances are actually within the criminal justice system. So, you know, thank you for enlightening me.
We totally try not to have to, because we're supposed to, if we think somebody is a true threat of suicide, we're supposed to report it to the jail, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really try not to ever have to do that because I just know that it's so unpleasant.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously, if I truly think someone's life is in danger, that's one thing. You know, I mean, there are people that make that claim in an effort to better their jail situation as well. You know, it's not everybody is a serious suicide attempt, but
what do you mean by better their jail situation?
Well, people that don't know what it's like in MedSeg might think that it's more comfortable. They might think that they'll go to a hospital. They don't, but they might think they would. So sometimes people will attempt suicide in a jail for purposes of getting attention. There are people that will attempt suicide in a jail to sort of fake bad or try and manufacture the appearance of mental illness when there isn't any.
Right. I can understand that, because I think that if I were in that position, not knowing anything about the realities of Suicide Watch, I would think that I'd either be taken to an infirmary where I'd have like a bed or I'd be taken to an actual hospital, in which case that would be just miles better than the circumstances I was, you know, enjoying. Yeah.
So I think people sometimes do it to manipulate the system, but sometimes people do it because they're just overwhelmed with the reality of their new situation.
Absolutely. I mean, how can any of us judge how we would react and then how our reactions would be, you know, considered by others? Some totally normal coping mechanisms under extremely trying circumstances could be viewed, I think, as like mental illness when it's just...
Well, and here, watch me tie this back to Samantha Hoff.
Let's do it.
You know, I mean, so much of what was talked about with her was that her testimony was very measured and that people were watching her to see if she looked innocent or looked guilty and what level of emotion she was experiencing. And people try and draw all sorts of conclusions about that when I don't think that you necessarily can, because also by the time somebody has a trial, they've heard all of this stuff 10,000 times.
Yeah.
You know, if anybody was ever in a high school play, do you remember what it was like by the time you got to opening night? Like, you knew your lines, you knew what was coming next. You knew what, you know, was going to show up on scene. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. The sort of shock value goes away because you're just exposed to it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so then people testifying, sometimes they're overcome by emotion, but a lot of times it's pretty calm compared to what you might expect.
Yeah, no, I can see that being true. I also get personally frustrated very easily when I hear people draw conclusions about others' behaviors following traumatic incidents. Like, well, I wouldn't behave like that after I experienced a traumatic incident. It's like, oh my God, like, how do you have any clue how you would react if your child was just murdered and you walk, you know what I mean? Like, how can you have any clue? Like,
I hate that stuff. Like, I just absolutely hate it, because what are we even, there's no predicting.
No.
You know, and then you, like, I can tell you some of the clients that I've had that have had the most trouble have been professionals in one capacity or another. And I'm going to use an example of a doctor, and I'm sort of blurring multiple clients I've had over the years together in this story. So it's not completely true to life, though it's certainly borrowing from truth.
Got it.
When someone is injured, and a doctor or a nurse calls 911, they use their terms of art in describing that person's condition.
Right.
That's, you know, that's normal. That's natural. Of course, you're going to give whatever. I mean, I suck at medical terms, but you're going to talk about their, you know, pulse ox, or you're going to talk about if their airway is obstructed or unobstructed. You're going to talk about that sort of thing. And a lot of times, juries will react negatively to that because they think it's clinical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm guilty of the same thing in that, like, in my state, if you are somebody who was sexually assaulted but didn't prosecute it, or maybe you did and the guy was acquitted, or maybe you did and the guy was convicted, but you are the victim of a sexual assault that is not the victim of the sexual assault that's on trial, you're what's called a witty witness. Because you're an other acts witness. And so I would describe, oh yeah, so-and-so is a witty witness, which in my lingo just means someone who wasn't the victim of the crime charged, who has information that could potentially be relevant, at least in terms of accusations of prior bad conduct. That could feel really dismissive to the trauma of the person that experienced it. And I don't mean it that way. It's just, that's who they are. Oh, they're a witty witness. You know, so when professionals find themselves in the criminal justice system, a lot of times lay people will hear that really, really negatively because it seems so detached. And I think that's very unfair because, you know, I mean, my mother's a nurse. She ran an ICU.
My mother's a nurse too.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, she ran an ICU for years. So when you talk to her about anything, she just goes through what the symptoms are.
Yeah.
And she lists it really matter of factly. And it's not, you know, it's not that she is disinterested in that or cold. It's just the way that her mind works.
Yeah.
And so I'm sympathetic to that. And I was very sympathetic to Samantha because as a woman that is acutely aware that when I show too much emotion, it can trigger biases like gender bias. I'm usually pretty put together in a courtroom, and that doesn't mean that I'm not feeling incredibly difficult things.
Yeah, no, I fully understand that. And in fact, before you mentioned your mom was a nurse, I was already thinking about my mom, and I was like, God, she better warn her, like, not to get accused of any crimes coming up.
Well, right, because if somebody were dying, your mother would probably render aid.
Yeah.
And she, as would mine. And they would describe the aid that they rendered in clinical terms.
Absolutely.
Because that's what they're trained to do.
Yeah, if she came home and her husband was, you know, bloodied on the floor and whatever, I just know that she would default to those very clinical terms. Because those are the terms she uses with me. Just, you know, situationally, like, familially, you know.
Right.
There is no other term.
And I think that's totally normal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all have, you know, I mean, just on a really basic level, and it's not even clinical, there are 3 going on 4 lawyers at my office. Our youngest one, our new associate, starts in January. She's clerking for us now. But we spend so much time together that we all talk in the same way. And when opposing counsel talks to us for the first time, they're like, oh, you work with so-and-so. You guys present things in the same way because we're just so used to, you know, I mean, we all have this conversation and it's ongoing and we adapt each other's lingo and mannerisms. And I mean, the same is true in a professional context as well. And that just gets ingrained in you. I mean, you can't stop it even if you want to.
Yeah, I can see that being used against people with military backgrounds.
Yep.
You know, because they're trained to, like, deal with trauma. They're trained, you know, to just be very focused. And
And there's no right answer to reacting to trauma.
I mean, there's no, like, imagining that everyone should fall to pieces in a crisis. That's a little bit silly, I think. But I also understand that it's, like, it's our human instinct to relate to a defendant and be like, well, what would I do in this position? You're really trying to envision it. And I don't know. It's sticky. It's just a sticky mess when you try to project yourself into another person's state of mind at a sensitive moment.
Oh, yeah. And, like, you know, obviously I try sex crimes. A big question that comes up over and over and over again in sexual assault trials is delays in reporting. And there's a lot of lit that suggests that children in particular don't report sexual abuse right away. That the majority of children never disclose sexual abuse, and that a smaller percentage that do disclose it months or years after it occurs.
Right.
And so there are a lot of expert witnesses that are called to say, like, look, the timing of the disclosure really doesn't have anything to do with the reliability of it. And that's science that I accept, actually. I don't necessarily think that just because something happens to you, you would immediately report it. I think there are a lot of good reasons that people don't.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I've been reading about that a lot recently, too, because it factors into, like, season two plot lines. But, like, delayed reporting is a reality that a lot of people find especially hard to accept when they're trying to hear the account of an alleged victim in a sensitive crime.
Right. Yeah. People struggle with it.
Yeah.
Which, sorry, I can't help myself. In terms of the reliability, I don't struggle with it. I think that people do process trauma differently. And I think that many people don't disclose right away. As a defense attorney, mm-hmm. I'd bump on that really hard, because if someone discloses immediately, we have this opportunity to collect all sorts of additional evidence.
Right.
And when somebody fails to disclose, that evidence goes away. And as just like a presumption of innocence defense attorney thing, I wish people would disclose right away, because then there would be this opportunity to collect this additional evidence. And then everyone could rest a little easier with convictions.
Right.
Because, you know, then you can get somebody to the hospital and you can collect DNA and you can check for signs of trauma and bruising and injury. And that ultimately makes the conviction more reliable. And so I root for people to disclose early, because I think it makes all of us feel, sleep a little easier knowing that there is corroborating evidence. So I am critical of it as a lawyer. I mean, I attack that really quite frequently, even though as a person, I understand that there are a lot of reasons that you might not immediately report trauma.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we've run the gamut tonight.
I know. I've gone all over. This is
no, I was leading you all over. I was like, tell me about Suicide Watch. Tell me about your experience here, there. Let's talk about nursing. Sorry.
Let's talk about nursing. We all know so much about nursing.
We know it all.
Chelsea and Jessa are just going to have a nursing podcast.
We won't piss anybody off that way.
We'll be super qualified.
I think teaching and I think nursing are the two most undervalued professions, or at least underpaid totally. Professions that exist.
Teachers should just be celebrated.
They
constantly.
Should.
So should nurses. Like, I completely agree with you. Those are the two that, like, everyone should be celebrated. No way that they're not.
I feel like both of those professions, it's just like a public service that they're doing it at all. And
totally.
You know, and it shows a real character and a real, like, belief in what they're doing, that they're willing to accept such low incomes in exchange for the extraordinary work they do. So
I completely agree with that.
So that's our tribute.
Yeah, that's our tribute. I'm going to just steer us back to sentencing because I know that you're doing this Samantha Hall sentencing episode.
I am.
And I want to talk just real briefly about the different ways, like the different philosophies behind a sentencing at any given point.
Great.
Because I think that that's useful for listeners to have. And I'm going to frame this in Wisconsin case law, but there's similar case law everywhere. When we look at sentencing, the primary objectives are dealing with the gravity of the offense, the need to protect the public, and the character of the offender. And then sort of secondary or ancillary considerations are both general and specific deterrence, the rehabilitative needs of the offender, retribution or punishment. Those are sort of the secondary objectives to those three, in my state at least, that we start with. And we're supposed to start with the idea that you don't incarcerate someone unless one of those factors is so overwhelming that to do anything but incarcerate them would fail to appreciate the seriousness of the offense. So when we're going into Samantha Hall, you know, we've got a death. She's been convicted of a death. That's going to be a serious offense. She has no criminal history, and I'm sure her defense attorney will present some mitigation in terms of who she is as a person. And then there's the need to protect the public. And the question is, you know, how likely is she to commit this type of offense again in the future? And then sort of the lesser considerations are, does she need to be punished? Does the sentence in this case affect the way the general public perceives their ability to commit similar offenses, which is, you know, the general deterrence idea, which I hate. Specific deterrence is, how do you teach this individual not to do this particular thing again? I would suggest that the most common form of individual deterrence is that, you know, her partner died. So she probably doesn't want that to happen in the future, assuming mm-hmm. that she's not a potential serial killer, which I don't think she is. You know, so those are kind of the different and sometimes conflicting ideas of a sentencing, because what is best for the defendant isn't necessarily what makes people feel a sense of justice or a retribution.
Right.
So those are the different things that judges think about at sentencing. And those are the different sort of principles that lawyers argue on either side of it.
I'm really glad that you laid out that framework, because I think it's really important to keep in mind. And it is a really complicated and difficult decision.
Oh, I would never want to be a judge.
You may be a judge one day, right?
No, not me. Not me. No? I have the job. No, I have the job I want. If you've been watching the Menendez brothers, the Law and Order True Crime, actually Leslie Abramson, as dramatized by Edie Falco, nails my personal opinion on it in the last episode, where she says, I don't want to be a judge because I'd have to be impartial. I'm not impartial. Like, people spend their entire lives walking around while disaster is striking being impartial, and I don't want to be that. That's how I am. I want to have a team. I want to have somebody to advocate for. I would really struggle to have to be neutral, because it's just not my personality. Now, Nate, my business partner, who is not part of Nick and my podcast, the third one of us, the Otis, he actually would do a lovely job as a judge, because he's like super even tempered and he's patient and he can see both sides of an issue. I have none of those positive qualities. I am not even tempered. I am not patient. And I typically don't see both sides of an issue.
But that's what makes you so excellent at what you do.
That, yeah, I mean, like, and without sounding like a total asshole for saying yes, like, yeah, I'm a really good fucking lawyer. And part of that is because I do invest my own, you know, I mean, I get personally invested and I care. I care about my clients a lot. And I care about justice. And I care about making sure that everyone gets their day in court and gets a zealous defense. And it would be very hard for me to set that aside and sort of play the role of somebody neutral.
Yeah,
because it's not who I am.
Well, speaking of who you are and how fantastic you both are as lawyers, would you please plug your amazing podcast for us before we sign off?
Sure. So Nick Ganser and I, one of my two business partners, are doing a podcast. We have, I think, a trailer and four episodes up. It's called Getting Off. You can find it on more or less every major podcasting platform at this point. We just published through Google Play, so we're good there now. It's on Apple Podcasts. It's on Stitcher. And what we do is we alternate between two sorts of episodes. We have sort of a broader policy episode where we talk about an issue in criminal justice. And then we pick a case that we think connects with that. And we do a deeper dive into the case to talk about the legal issues that come up. And we start with the actual crime. So there's an element of true crime to it. And then we go through the arrest, the charging, and the trial. If there's an acquittal, we talk about the consequences of that. If there's a sentencing, we talk about that. And we make really poorly formed jokes in the process. I will tell you, one of my favorite things is I get to title the episodes, and the level of pun that I want to use in all of them is, like, I'll keep telling Gansner, like, hey, I'm going to title it this. And he's like, oh, Jesus Christ, just tone it down, like, one shade. Like, just don't, you know, because, like, we did Brock Turner, and I was like, I want to call it Turnaround Bright Eyes.
And he, oh, my God.
And he was like, no.
And Nate was no.
No. But the second episode was Brock the Casbah, so that was my nod to The Clash. I won that one, but the first one was titled appropriately. So Nick and I are doing this. We have been totally overwhelmed by the number of supporters that we have. We love it. We're super excited about it. We're recording our next episode tomorrow. You can follow us at Getting Off Pod. That's on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. There's a Facebook group and a Facebook page. The email is gettingoffpod@gmail.com. We're just starting to get requests about cases, and we love that because we haven't heard of some of these things, and then we just wander off into, like, the internet ether. So if there are things that you guys want to hear about, if there are cases that you have questions about, let us know. We would love to hear from you because we're having a lot of fun.
Awesome. And shamelessly, I hope you do become a judgment day so these puns will come back to haunt you.
Oh, my God. All right. Like, just the sheer number, and I have no idea what your listener base does, but, like, if you Google me, basically, if anything horrible happened in the state of Wisconsin from about 2006 to present, I was probably the defense attorney. No one's ever electing me to any office. They're going to be like, she walked that fucking guy. She walked that fucking guy. Like, no, people are just going to look at that and be like, oh, yeah, the lady that loves rape. Let's elect
her. For sure.
It's fine. It's totally fine.
But guys, a note to take from that is if you want to commit a sensitive crime, do it in Wisconsin, because I know a guy, I know a really good lawyer there. I could probably get you a hookup.
And there you go.
She loves to get people walking.
I do.
Thanks again to Jessa for all of her contributions this season. Definitely check out Getting Off and tune in Wednesday for the second half of our jury group interview and a breakdown of what you can expect for season 2.